Welcome to episode 15 of Indestructible, Indestructible Latin America with Rodrigo Acuña. This podcast is a collaborative effort between myself and Alborada, an independent voice on Latin American politics, media, and culture based in the United Kingdom. I am a contributing editor of Alborada and am based in Sydney, Australia. If you like the content of this podcast, you may want to consider supporting us on Patreon. All of our patrons are now receiving a small selection of references to articles, podcasts, and books, which deal with some of the key topics discussed in each episode. Another way you can support us is by simply sharing this episode and letting your friends know about this podcast. You will find us on Spotify under the name Alborada, which is spelled A-L-B-O-R-A-D-A, and on Twitter and Facebook under Indestructible Podcast. On Instagram, you will find us under the title Indestructible Pod. In recent years, the president of El Salvador, Nayib Bukele, has been featured regularly in the international media, whether it be on his record in attempting to reduce El Salvador's serious gang violence and murder rate, or becoming the first country to make Bitcoin legal tender. Bukele has often been able to get a sympathetic hearing in the mainstream media for his administration, which governs a small Central American country with a population of over 6.5 million. In order to get a better understanding of what is happening in El Salvador, I recently spoke to Tatiana Marroquin on Nayib Bukele's track record. An independent economist, feminist, and human rights activist based in San Salvador, Tatiana also has postgraduate studies in finance and is a former legal analyst for the country's National Assembly. I now leave you with Tatiana Marroquin. Welcome to Indestructible Podcast, Tatiana Marroquin. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation and greetings to all the people who listen to us.
Fantastic. For the most part of this episode, I'd like for us to concentrate on the presidency of Nayib Bukele, who has been in power since 2019, and whose government has obtained much international attention for measures such as legalizing Bitcoin. Before we do this, I'd like for us to discuss the civil war in El Salvador, which lasted for 12 years between 1979 through to 1992. Now, according to the United Nations, some 75,000 people were killed, with approximately 8,000 disappeared. During this conflict, the United States, of course, poured approximately $4 billion to support the local fascist military junta and the hard-right Alianza Republicana Nacionalista, also known as the Arena Party, who were locked into a fierce civil war with large sections of the population and, of course, the leftist guerrilla movement, the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front. For our listeners, what could you tell us about this period of El Salvador's history?
Well, I was born in 1988, so I don't remember anything about that, but I remember very clearly the history of my family and other families and the people in El Salvador. And it was for sure a very traumatic period for El Salvador. And the Peace Accords, though not as comprehensive as needed, were a giant step forward, institutionalizing democratic diversity in El Salvador. So I remember stories of terror experienced in the Salvadorian War, about military abuse, attack of free expression, the impossibility of a truly democratic election, of political diversity in any area of society. So I grew up reading those stories, listening to those stories, even persecution of human rights defenders. And the thing is that I grew up imagining these stories as part of a past to which we will not return. So I clearly remember my mom telling me these stories, so we remember to not return to them. And suddenly in these years, those stories seems to be alive again. And that's actually something very scary for a lot of us who grew up at the light of the peace accords. So perhaps not under the format of the 1980s, but the same principles of state abuse, threats to press freedoms, indefinite re-elections in elections, or elections where the executive power controls all electoral institutions, persecution of human rights defenders, among others. So it's very difficult because I remember that past or those stories as something that will not happen again. And suddenly when we were watching TV or something like that, we see people being stopped in the buses and the military people register them so they cannot go to a march against the government, things like that. We are seeing and these stories be alive again in the society.
Mm-hmm. Now, with the signing of the peace accords in 1992, El Salvador, since the 1990s, has seen an explosion of youth gangs known as Las Maras. In 2005, according to U.S. authorities, their membership was placed around 70 to 100,000. What could you tell us about the gangs such as MS-13 or 18th Street? Why have they been so successful in recruiting the country's youth? And what are their main criminal activities?
Well, I'm not an expert on the topic, but I can speak to you from my experience. And I remember that in the early 90s, in El Salvador, the gangs were a very small group of young people who were not that organized. In the 90s, deportations grew up a lot, and the transformation of gang groups into more complex organization was observed. So we really saw the change of how these groups that we call Maras in El Salvador at the beginning of the 90s were influenced by people coming from, well, by Salvadorians coming from United States. So there's a phrase that had a great impact on me, and it was a documentary about gangs. And there was this gang member said that when they arrive at United States, they find a lot of gangs from other races wanted to beat them with a bat or making threats on them. And he was like, oh, what? They think they could scare us with that baseball bat when we have witnessed horrible killings in El Salvador. We came from a 12-year a war. They have no idea what it's violence. We're going to show him what it's violence. So for me, that phrase, it demonstrates how the violence has always been one of the main tools that El Salvador and the region has to confront problems in society. So even it's from the state with military abuse or the gangs, but it's always like we always have violence as a response. And yes, when they came and when they begin to organize here in El Salvador, there's a lot of young men without that they are not studying and they are not working or having any jobs. So, or they have no family. Like there's a lot of young kids in El Salvador that their mom or their dad or both of them are in United States, or they have left them. They have abandoned them. So I think that they, in some way, they think the gang as their family. So it's something that needs to be more studied, but I think that it's a mix between they found family in the gangs and the gangs, it's another way of El Salvador society to respond violent to a problem in society.
Another phenomenon which has gripped El Salvador for many decades is that of immigration. According to one of the reports I read in preparation for this interview, there are currently over 3 million Salvadorians living abroad, an estimated one-third of the population, of which 49.12% are women. During the presidency of Donald Trump, the U.S. government increased its efforts to deport Central American immigrants, with shocking images of children placed in cages in what the member of the U.S. House of Representatives for New York, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, called concentration camps. Would you be able to tell our audience a little about this crisis, and have there been any governments in power since the end of the Civil War that have attempted to create vast amounts of jobs and tackle the issue of immigration?
Well, immigration is it's a very complex phenomenon, and it's becoming more and more difficult each time. El Salvador, along with Honduras and Guatemala, has a large amount of immigration, and the reasons are very similar. So when you ask them why they are immigrating, it's the economy, they are running away from violence, and this is very recently, but it's getting higher. It's the family reunification. So for the first one, which is the main reason, the economic reason, it's actually very difficult, because in El Salvador, there's governments who have been like, they have tried to create more jobs, but with these right-wing ideas of what type of politics you need to create jobs, like maquilas, which is, let me just, well, fabrics where there's a lot of workers made in t-shirts or making clothes. So they actually give benefits from taxes to these companies, so they can create jobs. But that hasn't been like, it has created jobs, but not that much. And they never actually really think of what type of jobs they were creating. So this type of worker, these workers has very low wages. And actually it's not contributing to the solution of poverty in El Salvador. So no, at this point, there's no one government that has actually tried to transform economy in El Salvador. So it could be a source of life for the people, like people can live in everyday basis without being afraid of poverty or starving or all those type of things. So and the thing is that I stated that it was more difficult right now. It's because with family reunification, it's really hard, because there's a lot of kids that are immigrating right now, and there's nothing you can do to make them stop, because family reunification is something that you cannot done unless you deport everyone from United States. And that's something that we cannot handle as a society, and it could be something really horrible for the people who live in United States. Because there's something that I have seen very clearly in El Salvador, it's that people that it's being deported, they are actually, most of them, if they have like 20, 25 years living in United States, they are United States citizens, although they don't have legal documents, but they have the culture of United States. So they are being exposed by their country and coming back here And it's a really tragic situation for all of them. So in both cases, in people who lives in United States and it's being deported, and people who's trying to go there to reunificate with them or to have a better life, it's a really tragedy. There's no one like going to United States and having like a great time in the meantime. It's actually it's coming from despair, from an actual despair.
Prior to becoming president of El Salvador, Nayib Bukele served as mayor of Nuevo Castellán, I understand, for 3 years from 2012 to 2015, and then as mayor of San Salvador, the nation's capital, from 2015 to 2018. After winning both mayoral elections as a member of the FMLN, in 2017, he was expelled from the party. Why do you think this expulsion occurred, and what was his record as a politician before becoming president?
Well, I clearly remember him in their first this first ep episode as mayor of Nuevo Cuscatlán. And actually from the beginning he was visualized, I visualize him as very good on handling communications. So I remember reading an interview when he was saying that he's from the far left. He was a really far left politician. So I remember reading that story, and because I am from the left, recognizing that actually he was not, he has not the principles or the knowledge to be someone from, to be a leftist. But he was selling himself as a leftist at the beginning of his career as a politician. So I in my case, I can tell you that from the beginning, I don't like Nayib Bukele as a politician, because I clearly see that he was telling whatever the people wanted to listen to. And no, he has no principles. He just says whatever suits him better at that time. So I recognized that at the beginning, and then I follow him. I follow his career, but from a very criticized view. So when he was expelled from FMLN, I remember that actually there was a fight because he wanted to be the next candidate for FMLN. And there has been a lot of issues with him and him being violent with some of the militants in FMLN, women actually. So there was a lot of reasons, like reasons from the normative inside of FMLN to actually expel him. So there was enough reasons for that. But I think that in politic terms, the main reason was that he really wanted to be the next candidate. And the people in FMLN, the people who was actually in power in FMLN, don't wanted to be him the next candidate from FMLN, because they can control them. I remember some people telling them we can control them. When he If he's in power, we will not be able to say that it's an FMLN government. It will be Nayib Bukele's government. And from that point of view, I think they were right about it.
By the end of 2019, and in an interview with Al Jazeera, Bukele claimed he reduced El Salvador's crime rate by 60%. Now, by any stretch, this seems like a remarkable claim after only 6 months in office. Is there any serious evidence, in your opinion, that Bukele has reduced the country's crime rates? And if so, what have been his policies in order to achieve this?
Well, it for sure it's a fact that it has reduced the homicide rates in El Salvador. What we don't know is we have no idea of how, in which way, or what state resources he has used to achieve this goal. So we have some information about the government having a truce with the gangs. So there's enough information and actually even declarations for people from the government telling gangs, so okay, we have this agreement and we should be careful about this agreement that we have. But in terms of like a public policy, we have no idea what's behind the suddenly homicide rate being down. But a few weeks ago, we have seen tragically a race on the like 2 days of race on homicides. And there was also information about that 2 days being a clear example of this truce being broke by this truce with the government and the gangs being broke. So as soon as we saw those 2 days of a lot of homicides, he started the state of exception, which is another like tool that he has against the gangs. So at this point, we don't know. Well, the homicides rates are low again, but the government is telling that it's because of a state of exception. But we have not state of exception before, and we have low rates of homicides. So at this point, it's very unclear what the government is doing and how he's handling the gangs right now. I don't know if it's by an agreement or if he's by just being really violent to them. What I can tell you is that in the middle of this truce between the gangs and the government, there's Salvadorian population, and that are suffering all these actions from the government. Like state of exception has caused a lot of damage in a lot of people in El Salvador, and just by being in the middle of where the gangs are located, the territories where the gangs are located, and what the government is doing against them.
And I'm guessing there has been a process also of mass incarceration, which would be quite rapid. If is that taking place as well?
Yeah. Well, the state of exception has eliminated due process in El Salvador. So the right to defense in a fair criminal proceeding is totally lost. And there has been mass arrest in El Salvador, but they are profiled by class and by race, more than a serious investigation of the possibility of having committed crimes. So you can actually call police and say, my neighbor is from a gang, and they just came and take them to jail without no further investigation. And before the state of exception, you have up to 3 days. So the state could actually make a case about you, or try to make you guilty of something. But at this point, there's been people who has like 30, 60 days in jail without any judge seeing his this their cases. So it's a very very sad and very tragic situation that we are living in, state of exception.
Now, El Salvador, of course, also has a crisis with femicide. According to an article published in NACLA, and I quote, a 2017 survey found that 67% of Salvadorian women had experienced some form of violence in their lives. And in 2019, the country had one of the highest femicide rates in Latin America, second only to Honduras. What is the current administration doing about this issue?
They are hiding statistics about femicides. So it's really tragic. We have developed some type of politics against gender-based violence in El Salvador before. So we have a law and we have some institutions, but most of the institutions have been actually weakened by this government. So they take money from them, or they actually make weaker all the institutions that were in charge of gender-based violence in El Salvador. But at this point, at the beginning of his government, he was like, okay, because the homicide rate was lower. Also, the feminicide rate was lower. So he was like, okay, feminicides already, they're not a problem anymore in El Salvador. So I remember the feminist organizations fighting about this idea, like it's already solved, like the problem is already solved. And we were like, no, it's not solved. By gender-based violence against women is still there. And actually the government was like, no, that's how you measure the violence against women. So if there's no feminicides, so there's no problem there. And there a few months ago, we have seen a lot of congresswomen from the government side, from Nayib Bukele's party, stating that actually the law that we have for violence against women, it's not good anymore, or it's not good, it's not helping at all, and that it's unfair that women have a law and not men. So those clearly false statements against what feminists are fighting in El Salvador are very popular right now. And most organizations, civil organizations that follow the statistics and the problems on violence against women are claiming that there's a lot of information that it's being hidden from the people, including the feminicide rate.
Mm-hmm. Now, in late 2021, Bukele legalized Bitcoin, being the first country in the world to do so. What was the reason for this measure, and has it benefited the majority of the country's population?
I'm an economist, so I'm very used to actually investigate about public policy or economy policies. And actually, there's no paper, or there's no document or some technical information that can tell you what are the actual objectives of this measure. So if you research on them, if you saw all the declarations that the president has been doing, or even the meetings that they have with the IMF, you can see at least three objectives that they are claiming that they had for making Bitcoin a currency in El Salvador. And the first one is financial inclusion. And the second one is attracting tourism. And the third one is rebranding El Salvador, which is very, very related with the second one, which is attracting tourism. For the first one, which is financial inclusion, it actually respond the second question you were telling me, and if it's helping people in El Salvador, and no, like most of people in El Salvador is not using Bitcoin, even though they can use Bitcoin, and the government has actually incentivized the use of Bitcoin. They had a wallet from the government, and they have give a $30 bonus if you use the wallet. So we have some surveys about what it's if it's being used or not, and like 60% of people in El Salvador downloaded the wallet, but most of them, like 60 to 80% of people, just use it to take the bonus, the $30 bonus, and never use it again. So no, most of people in El Salvador is not using the wallet, is not using Bitcoin. And it has not changed the economy or the situation of majority of people in El Salvador. Actually, it has been very difficult and has more troubles for public funds and for financial situation from the government.
Finally, what could you tell us about Bukele's foreign policy? As is well known, historically, most Central American presidents and military dictatorships have had the support of the United States. They really often don't even come to power without the green light from the United States. With the return of the pink tide in Latin America and such far-right presidents as Jair Bolsonaro in power in Brazil, where can Bukele's presidency be placed within the region's political spectrum?
Well, that's very difficult. He's not he came from the left, but as I tell you before, he doesn't have the principles or the knowledge to be a leftist. He's more a right-wing person, but his government, actually, it's like an anti-politics politic. So he used whatever suits him better at that time. If chanting about against businessmen will help him to be more popular, he will do it on Monday. And on Tuesday, he will be holding hands with the richest businessman in El Salvador. What you can see him clearly, it's that he's an anti-politics. He's always speaking about how politicians are the problem, and he's always speaking like he's not a politician. He's like this alien who has fall from the sky, and he's actually the good one, and not like the rest of them. But in terms of like economics, I can tell you that he's more a right-wing politician. He has not like their priorities are not like development, social programs, or something like that. Actually, Bitcoin and the way he has developed the idea of Bitcoin in El Salvador is very right-wing, like taking taxes from investors, or giving the idea of Bitcoin City. It's like giving this territory to private people. So in terms of economics, it's more right-wing. But in terms of how he's speak to the people, and he has a lot of leftist tradition there. So he used whatever suits him better. And actually, in foreign policy, he's like that. Like, for example, United States, it went from a really good friend from El Salvador to an enemy right now, based on how they are taking the actions of Nayib Bukele's government right now. So he changed to whatever suits him better. You cannot, whatever he is saying or doing at the moment, it's not based on principles. It's based on communication strategy, on how, on what makes him more popular at that moment.
So in summary, he sounds like a serious opportunist, a political opportunist. Yeah. Tatiana Marroquin, an economist, an activist, thank you so much for joining us here at Indestructible Podcast. Your comments and insights into El Salvador have been are very much appreciated. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the invitation and greetings from El Salvador, and thank you for putting attention on what is happening in El Salvador.
Thank you very much. As always, I would like to thank Alborada for this opportunity to host Indestructible, Indestructible. Once again, I would encourage our listeners to support this podcast on Patreon, which you can do for as little as the price of one cup of coffee per month. My sincere thanks, as always, goes to Alborada's founder and co-editor, Pablo Navarrete, who produces this podcast. If you have any comments on this episode, please write to us on our email, which you will find on Alborada's website. We'll be back soon with episode 16, but until then, goodbye and stay safe.